Hi, I'm Marcus Jones, Chief Digital Officer at Premier, which produces this podcast and many others. Like you, I love listening to these amazing podcasts. I also love hearing about the people who are impacted by them, like Sheila from Cheshire. Sheila's parents were both sick and she was going through a difficult time taking care of them. But she started listening to Premier's podcasts and God spoke to her through them with just the right thing she needed to hear at just the right moment. She felt reassured that God had it in hand and that her parents would be safe. It's incredible to know how important these podcasts are to so many, but they are listener funded, which means we need your support to keep them going for people like Sheila. This week, we come to the end of our financial year with our funding need yet to be met. Would you consider a donation today to help us reach more people like Sheila with hope and encouragement through our podcasts? Give your gift today at premier.plus/donate. That's premier.plus/donate. Thank you.
I got a phone call from America. I have no idea how they got wind of my song, but this guy on the other side said, look, we have heard your song. You've written a song called Elijah. I remember correcting him and saying, no, Des. I said, look, we'd like to come and record it in Northern Ireland. And I thought, really?
The Profile. You're listening to Premier Christian Radio.
Hello and welcome to The Profile here on Premier Christian Radio. I'm Sam Hales, editor of Premier Christianity magazine. If you'd like a free sample copy of our latest issue featuring reviews, interviews, news and so much more, then head to premierchristianity.com/free sample. Today, I'm speaking with the Northern Irish worship leader, Robin Mark. Robin is the writer of many songs which are sung all over the world, including Days of Elijah, You're the Lion of Judah, and Take Us to the River. He's released 13 albums with sales of over 2 million worldwide. He's also the first UK-based artist to reach number one in the USA's Christian retail charts. Robin, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Sam. It's a pleasure to be with you.
So we always like to start with these interviews about hearing about a person's life growing up. Now, obviously, you grew up in a pretty interesting part of the world, if I can use that word. Tell me a little bit about what life was like for you growing up.
Well, I was born in Belfast, and in fact, I was born in Donegal Pass in Belfast, which is on the south side, very working class sort of a area, and my parents were sort of working class. They moved over to the East Belfast. We were city dwellers, that's for sure. And really, probably about the age of about 14, 15, 16, that's when the troubles began in Northern Ireland, because as many people, well, as practically the entire world knows, there was a political argument, really, and it became a religious argument, and then it became all sorts of things, and we just dubbed it the Troubles, but they lasted for many years, and with all sorts of consequences. I think most of us, including myself, look back at those days, and we tell the stories of those days, because it's past, you know. That's one of the things about life, I suppose, that as times passed, things that were absolutely horrendous when you were in the middle of it have become good stories you can tell your children. You know, we keep on, it's a terrible thing to say, I hope no one's offended, but we keep on sort of saying to our kids, because they're frightened of COVID-19, and that whole thing's really shaking them around, and we say, you think this is bad? You should have lived when we did, you see. So is that's sort of the thing. But the Northern Ireland people and the population, of course, are in the worst situations, generally very stoic. And there's a good sense of God's favor on the country that we live in. And there's a real high level of people who are acknowledging that, you know, the Father, God the Father, and Jesus Christ. So it was a balance of something, a balance of living in a place which was very beautiful, but very, very troubled. And I got here anyway. Let's just say we got through it.
You know? You got through it, absolutely. So can you remember, as a teenager, can you remember violence? Can you remember clashes? Or were you sort of shielded from that?
I remember talking to an American person, and they asked me, you know, like, did anything ever happen to you? And I said, well, not really. And then I started to list the things. You know, I was traveling back home in a bus from the city center when the bus was attacked by rioters. And I ended up in the back of an army ambulance, taken to the army base where the army medic actually fixed me up and then sent me off home again. So, you know, that was for like semi-normal.
Right. Yeah.
Bizarre when you think back on it. And when I worked, I was left school because I was basically in a working class environment. They didn't really think about going to university initially. So I left school when I was 16. And I worked in the center of Belfast in an office. And one day coming back from lunch in the office, we were walking up Donegal Street, and there was this huge bang at the top of Donegal Street because the terrorists had stuck a bomb in my office, would you believe? The building that the office was in was there. And I can remember, there was quite a lot of people in the street, but I can remember a guy grabbing a whole lot of us and throwing us against the wall of the properties there, which I didn't understand what he was doing initially, but what he was trying to do was to get us away from the breaking glass that was sort of beginning to shower down on the ground and around where we were. And of course, when it all stopped and we all looked back and I looked up and saw my office, you know, in a very poor state of structure, I actually just started to walk back up to my office. You know, so it's funny, you're in the middle of all those sorts of things that seem terrible. You have a sort of a normality that sets in. So that was, but I was one of the lucky ones. There were so many people who died. I think it was 3,500 people died in the Troubles. Many, many more thousands were injured, etc. And you can even, people may know that they're trying to recompense people who got very badly injured in the Troubles through none of their own sort of fault. And they're trying to sort that. And even now, decades from that time, we're still trying to fix that out, and there's still people suffering. So it was not a nice time, but it was the time of my life, I suppose.
Yes, and as you say, when you're living it, you just think it's normal. And I guess it's only with hindsight looking back, you think in many ways probably quite an abnormal upbringing and childhood. But tell me a little bit about where faiths came into the picture. What kind of a Christianity were you brought up with?
Right, well, I must admit, about two or three months ago, I did a little concert, a small free concert in a Brethren church who asked me to come and which was really a very nice thing to do. And it started me sort of reminding myself of the fact that when I was a tiny little boy in the part of East Belfast where I was living then, there was a gospel hall and they had a children's meeting. And, you know, this is the sort of prerogative of the gospel hall. They're fantastic people, etc. And so they crammed, and actually I checked this out, about 600 rascals, I suppose, including me, into a wee gospel hall every Tuesday night. And if you know anything about the Brethren, they're very biblically set. They sing. They enjoy singing without any music sometimes, but and they taught us basically about Christ and salvation and who we were and how God loved us, etc. And I actually, on that concert, which was just, I say, a couple of months ago, in the middle of the concert, I stopped it and I sort of said, you know what, guys, I want to thank you, you know, because these were all Brethren people sitting in front of me. I said, I want to thank you that, you know, I was just a little lad, had no idea, and your little church actually rescued me, basically. and give me a sense and an understanding of what Christ has done for me. And here I am all those years later. So I started there and continued, joined a Methodist church finally, and met my wife there. And we got married in the Methodist church, and I haven't looked back, actually, you know. So I don't know how much more you want to know. It could be really boring at this point.
No, it's interesting stuff. It's always interesting to hear how people's sort of faith journey has sort of changed over time. So you went from Brethren to Methodist. Are you still in the Methodist church now?
No, I'm not, actually. Because what happened was we got married, and when you get married, you don't have any money. So you buy houses that are way out of the city, et cetera, because they're cheaper. So we did that, and we bought a house or a bit of a house in a place called Carriduff. And when we were sort of there and settled in, we went looking for the Methodist church close by, of which there was not one. So we sort of kept back, kept going back to Belfast, et cetera. And we knew some people in a church called Christian Fellowship Church. When our first child came, we thought we had better go to a church that's sort of family orientated and be there. And so we moved into CFC. CFC, I think a lot of people may be listening to this and or whatever, will know CFC. Paul Reed was the pastor there, and he became a great friend. And actually, I've been there with my wife, and my whole family is there for the last 30, 40 years, actually.
Wow.
We've been stuck there, you know. So it's still a great church, actually, and we still go. Although I have to say that following many trends in the church calendar, we have a cafe church that you can go to, you know. It basically is supposed to be for people who don't really like the idea of church but might like to have a cup of coffee and sort of thing. So we actually now go to cafe church. And we'll love that, but it's still in CFC. So
sure. We'll come back to your story in a minute, but we should just pause here and acknowledge, of course, that I don't know exactly what the rules are in your part of the world, and obviously these legislation and rules and guidelines are changing all the time. But right now, for my local church, we're not allowed to sing. Yes. Not allowed to sing together. Is that the case where you are at the moment as well?
Yes, it is, actually. Now, I was talking to a friend of mine yesterday, and I said, because we're trying to open up cafe church again, and I thought, oh great. And I was talking to him, and I said, we won't be able to sing. And he says, oh no, I think you can. So I don't, it's one of those.
No one knows, do they?
Don't send anybody up the wrong track, but like everything that comes on the radio, you know, it seems to change every day.
Yes, it
but
does.
I think they're allowing the one singer or one guitarist or leader, if you like, to sing. But the congregation,
yes,
has to just sit and listen.
Yeah, which is so, I mean, even having this conversation, who could have predicted we'd have this conversation even a year ago, 2 years ago? And I'm mindful, you know, some people might be listening to this conversation in a few years' time and be thinking, what are they on about? Why can't they sing? So just to clarify, I should clarify, COVID, we're in the middle of COVID right now. No one knows when it's going to end. And we're told, at least, that singing is one of the main ways that we could spread this pretty deadly virus. But for you as a worship leader, this is a pretty big deal, right? I mean, I know as Christians, we often say, you know, worship is about so much more than singing, and it's right we acknowledge that. But at the same time, most churches across the world, you know, singing is a really important part of what we do together on a Sunday. And I think a lot of Christians are really missing that.
Yeah, I think so too. And yes, you're right. And I know, because we have to keep the best part of our mind, I think we have to keep the fact that, yes, worship, you know, takes in all sorts of things and all sorts of, even just lifestyle and all the rest of the stuff. But there's something about sung worship which is very powerful. And it has an impact on people, and it has an impact on societies. And that idea of music being, you know, given, and us, you know, being able to bless the heart of God just by singing songs and singing His praise is a fantastic thing, you know. So, and to have that taken away, I really do feel it's a very sad time. And the best thing that we can do, of course, and which most of us do, is just sing away to our heart's content in our own homes and whatever, and continue to worship the Lord. But you're right, I miss it, and you know, I'm looking forward to the day when whoever those Oxford sort of clinical people are that are trying to find this antivirus, I'm looking forward to the day that they say, it's gone. You know? Let's all sing.
But do you think if this does, you know, if God forbid, if this were to carry on for months or even years, and if the church is still being told, let's say for the sake of argument, if in a year's time the church is still being told you can't sing, like, at that point, would you actually support Christians campaigning a bit harder and telling the government, actually, this isn't on? You know, is there a line when actually we say as Christians, look, I'm sorry, government, but our faith comes first, and if worship is a really important part of singing, we're going to have to break the rules? I mean, could you foresee a time where we might end up in that position?
Yeah, I hope not, actually. I always sort of think, well, we've got a responsibility as Christians to sort of not subjugate ourselves to all sorts of different ideas that governments might have, but actually to be responsible. And if I believe that it is a problem, you know, that if it is scientifically likely that people, when they're singing together, will pass that virus, I think the church has to just say, well, we've got to do the right thing. It's all about God's love and God bringing people to health and vitality and to live a great life, et cetera, et cetera. So we don't want to do anything that I think gives the church a bad image in a sense. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe I'm a wimp, you see, and I just like to do as I'm told. Probably because my wife has been sort of, you know, saying that for a long time. But I know, you know, I think there are things that obviously that the churches have to stand up and say, no, this is just a bridge too far, and
sure,
no, we don't support this. But I think for this particular circumstance,
yeah,
it's very sad. And I mean, I've been blessed to be able to do concerts and stuff like that. You know, life has changed for me, different times, etc. I've been all over the world and America and all that. And I miss all that, you know, because basically that has just been cancelled. But it might help us, actually, and it might help somebody like me who sings and has music so much to realise again that there are other ways of worshipping the Lord and other ways of actually praising his name, you know, outside of just the...
Coming back to your story, tell me a bit about how you were called into worship music, worship ministry, worship leading. When did that idea, I guess, first cross your path? Because I guess we should acknowledge that even the term worship leader is quite a new term, isn't it?
It is, yes. I know, and I know that still some people don't like it as a name, and I can understand that. I when we moved from the Methodist Church and started to go to CFC, that was just the beginning of I suppose, the worship movement in the United Kingdom. And sort of people like Graham Kendrick and all those guys were there. And so because I was sort of musical, you know, I got interested in that and got sort of like, oh, you know, that's really good. I loved some of those lovely songs that they were writing. I was delighted to sing them, etc. And but anyway, I joined CFC. And as I say, that was from the Methodist Church. We had a small baby girl at that time. And this is a true story, okay? So I'd been doing little bits and pieces, but mainly stuff like weddings, right? So I was doing a wedding for someone, I can't even remember who, and Paul Reed, the pastor from CFC, was at the wedding. Now, this is the story as he tells it, so it's not made up. So he was sitting in the wedding, and he felt that I was playing the wedding songs. I don't even know what it was. And he said later on, he said, look, I felt God say to me, that guy is going to be the worship leader in your church. Now, at that time, he went to CFC, but he wasn't the pastor there, et cetera. He was just another one of the leaders, et cetera. So he thought... In fact, as he says, as he tells the story to me, he says, so I thought, I don't even know who that guy is, Lord. And that was it. So roll on about 2 or 3 months later, and Jackie and me and our little baby turn up to CFC. And we walk in, and I have a babe in arms and I go and sit down. The church isn't exactly the way that we thought it was and was going to be. But we sat down and Paul was preaching that day and also leading the worship. Now, Paul Reed cannot sing. Let me sing that. So he was leading in a brethren type thing called lining out, which was just, you know, conducting with your hands and singing. And he's not a bad singer, but he's not a great singer. And so he was doing that at the front. There had been a problem. It never happens in churches, sure it doesn't, between various factions in CFC that wanted to do this and the other. And there was a little bit of turmoil going on. So they put him in that command. And he looked down the congregation, and I'm sitting there with Jacqueline, my wife, and he felt God say, there's that guy that's going to be your worship leader. So believe it or not, he rang me up about a day or two later, and he said, would you like to lead worship in our church? And my actual answer was, well, what do you mean? Like, just one day or what? And he said, well, tell you what, let's do it next Sunday and see what happens. And that was how I became a worship leader in CFC. It was bizarre and a little bit weird. But the musicians, actually, that were all a little bit upset because of the turmoil in the church, they came alongside and helped me out. I'd never done worship like that, actually, up until that time. I'd sung a lot of things, but I'd never had a band with me and all that type of thing. And we got there and just boom. That was it. It started there, and then it grew.
What I find fascinating about that is, although, of course, you have travelled and ministered many places, in terms of being a worship leader at a church, you've only really been a worship leader at one church, I suppose.
That's right, actually, yeah. It's at CFC, and I am a little bit retired at the minute. But
right. But I just find that a fascinating contrast to, I guess, particularly some parts of America where, you know, you're a worship pastor and you sort of move around and you become a worship pastor at this church, then you're here. And even just the whole touring thing in America, you know, I understand a lot of American worship leaders, they're quite rarely at their local church because they're so busy touring the country. It's quite different for you, it sounds like. You've really kind of had a home in one church for a long time. And I guess there's something to be said there, right? For faithfulness, for longevity, for staying put and for working hard in one place.
Yeah, I think so. It's very kind of you to say so. But I suppose because of the situation we were in, we weren't even aware of that type of an idea. But I remember that Paul Reed, who's still alive and well, of course, and I'm sure you know him, but I remember him coming to me and said, you know, do you remember when we started this? And he said, I preached and you led the worship and we did morning service and evening service every single weekend for years and years, basically. And that was it. And we did it and we loved it. And the church grew under it. And you're right. I have to be careful because it's everybody, you know, has their own opinions. But I do feel that the call of a worship leader is a fantastic call. But the core of that call is that you're bringing people in a congregation into a place where they can worship, where they can, you know, be worshipers as well and worship well with you and your people and elevate the name of Jesus Christ, really. And that is better than if you travel all the world and sing wherever. And I've been fortunate to be able to do that. But I must admit, I'm glad that the circumstances worked out that way. Because I think that anything that I've done in the past and anything that I've done, even in the number of, you know, albums and stuff like that, it's still just the greatest pleasure is seeing people worship and engaged and lifting up the name of Jesus Christ. And so, yes, I'm on your side. Yes, I think, you know, I don't want to be smart aleck, but there is a sort of a sense sometimes that people say, you know, well, I'll be a worship leader and then I'll be famous.
Right.
And you know, there's only one person that needs to be famous and that's Christ himself.
Yeah.
You know? So it's, and that's what you try to do.
Yeah, absolutely.
But
Yeah. So tell me a bit about how you started to write songs and how those songs started to travel. Because my understanding is the songs started to travel before you did, if I can put it that way.
they did. I mean, I hadn't been sort of trained in how you write a song, you see. And so, but it just was, there was something in you. And I'm one of the types of writers that I am. In fact, it's the only type of writer that is something has to catch my mind, or I have to be inspired. In fact, my wife sometimes makes fun of me when I'm writing songs, because she sort of goes, "Oh, here we go. He has to be inspired. He can't write anything that's inspired." Well, you know, so some of the things that happened in the city, you know, in Belfast at that time, you see, you get inspiration from that. And circumstances that you see in a society like we had at that time, and things that you see in your friends, etc. That's the only way I'm able to write. And I have to say that they did drag me over to America fairly early on, and they put me in a room with about four other guys who were worship leaders, and said, "Here, Robin, we want you to write a song with some of our guys here." And it was the most embarrassing day of my life, actually. I sat in the corner of that room trying to figure out something. And they kept saying, "What do you think the line should be here, Robin?" And I was sort of going, "Well, I don't know, you know," because it just didn't, there wasn't anything to think about. So everything that has happened. In fact, practically every song that I've ever wrote that has ever meant anything or got anywhere is a song that actually was based on something that happened, or a place that I was at, or something that happened in my life or in someone else's life. And even in Northern Ireland, you need to sort of think about what's happening there and write a song about it. And that's the way I've done it. And
yeah.
In any other way. So
yeah. So tell me, let's start perhaps with the song you're best known for, Days of Elijah. Yeah. Tell me a bit about the story behind, what was the prod behind that song?
I will. Actually, back in 1994, right? Now, this is 1994 when it was written. And that was the year of the Rwandan genocide. I don't know if you remember that. I was very fond of watching a program called The Review of the Year. And The Review of the Year is put on by BBC at the end of a year, and then you watch it and they tell you all the stories and the news stories, etc. So I had watched this one night, and I'd actually forgotten. We're getting towards the end of the year in 1995, I think, and the Rwandan genocide had taken place from the previous year and was at that time slightly less active than it was at the time. But I'm sitting in my house, in fact this house here where I'm actually sitting right now, and watching this, it was horrendous, because what the BBC had done, because it was a late night show, Review of the Year, then they showed some of the stuff that happened that they wouldn't have shown on the midday or the evening news, and it was horrendous. It was brutal. And it was, people being put to death by blunt instrument and stuff like that, you know. So it was just really unbelievable. And I was watching this, and I actually started to shout at God, which is not a good idea, but I did. And I said, "How did you let that happen, Lord? How could you let that happen? How did you let that? That's a million people were put to death. My population of my country is 1.5 million. So that's like 2/3 of the population of Northern Ireland put to death by blunt instrument because of tribal strife." And of course, Northern Ireland was a place that had tribal strife. And so I started to argue and sort of shout a bit at God. And then I said this, I said, "What sort of days are we living in, Lord?" I was just angry. And, I got a sense, it wasn't an actual heard voice, but I just got a sense that God responded and says, "Robin, these are the days that my servants have had to live through all through history. You know, men like Elijah, et cetera, et cetera." You know, and it started to reel off in my head the things that God had, you know, asked Elijah, for example, to do. He had to sort of set aside the prophets of Baal. And when he did that and got rid of them, of course, he ran away because the queen and the king were going to try and kill him and stuff like that. And you know, I just got this sense of God saying, Robin, these are my days, but they're days when you and your friends and my church need to stand up and declare the gospel and declare the love of Christ and declare my greatness and declare me as the God of God and the King of Kings. And so that was me sitting there. And I can remember, actually, I think I was sitting with a big bag of chips or crisps, if you like, and a cup of Coke or something like that there, just sort of shouting at the television screen, would you believe? And but that final line, that, you know, sense that God said to me, Robin, these are days like Elijah's days. And that was it.
Right.
I just sort of thought, I actually went a couple of days later, I sat down and I wrote, these are the days of Elijah. I went to church and we sang it. We sang it right the way through. And I began, I can remember saying this, I said to the congregation, I've written a new song, but it's a bit odd. So, which is not a good start, really. And I said, so look, you know, let's try. I told this a bit of the story and then started to sing the song. Got to the end of the song and Paul Reed, God bless him, he said, sing that again. And we did. He got up and preached, and he actually had the preach that he did that day was the Valley of Dry Bones, which is another part of the song.
Right. Yeah.
And you know, he wanted to preach, and he took this theme from that, and the preach was that, look, you know, sometimes the church looks as if it's dead. It looks dusty and boring and useless, etc. But God can, with His Holy Spirit, bring it back to life and make it a powerful force for the gospel and for Christ and for the world. And I did get into some trouble with it. You know, some people thought that I was saying something different, really, you know. And I must tell you this, actually, Sam, because people sometimes do write to me and they say, look, David didn't rebuild the temple. It was Solomon that built the temple, you see. But because of my erstwhile reading the Bible all over the place, in the book of Amos, it talks about the rebuilding David's temple. And it's, right, it's to do with worship. The theologians say it's all to do with worship, you see. And so when Amos says, you know, that God is going to restore David's temple, what he's saying is, I'm going to bring worship back into the and so that's what happened, and that's where it came from. So
there you go.
Theologically correct.
There you go. It passed all the theological tests. That's good to know.
I know. But, everybody's allowed their own opinion, you know.
Well, you say it's an odd song. I'm all for odd songs. I think if we don't have the occasional curveball, then everything starts to sound the same, and we don't want that.
No, we don't. We don't. And I do know as well, and I have to be careful because it isn't fair to just, you know, sit up on a high chair and speak at other people or say not nice things. But I do think that we do a lot of me songs, you know, where we ask God for all sorts of things. And that's a good thing because it's a song of supplication. But sometimes I do miss the songs where people just declare who He is, what He's done, how great He is. And, you know, some of those songs, some of those really old songs, you know, that are out there, that where the guys sang songs like with lyrics saying like, God, do whatever you want with me. Mm. You know, I'm your servant and I'll do whatever you want, you know. And what was it Esther said? If I die, I die. Right. So that's you know, I wonder, could we get that into a worship song? Actually, but
that's a challenging thought. I know what you mean. I mean, yeah. Even back in the, I guess the 90s, you know, I surrender all.
Yeah, yeah.
That sort of language. I know what you mean. That was around in our songs, perhaps more then than now, yeah. I suppose. Yes, I suppose today a lot of our songs are a little bit more, come on, God, do this and do that.
Yes, I think so. And I know there is a place for that because I've sung a few of them myself, you know, definitely. But I do think that the core of worship is just to exalt God's name and just declare it. And like, you know, like I said, whatever he wants to do, he's sovereign. Let him do it.
Sure, his gold is precious and the honey sweet. So you love this city and you love these streets. Every child out playing by their own front door. Every baby laying on the bedroom floor. Every dreamer dreaming in their dead end job. Every driver driving through the rush of all. I feel it in my spirit, feel it in my bones. Send revival, bring them all back home.
Wanted to chat about another one of your songs that's very well known. I mean, obviously, I won't go through your entire back catalogue. We'll be here forever. But one of them that I really wanted to ask you about is called Revival. Because I think especially because that word for different Christians will mean different things. So I just wanted to ask you, now, how do you kind of define and see that word, and what was in your mind and what was the context, I suppose, for that song?
Yeah, well, I must tell you that, of course, I wrote it, and of course, this is like a backward explanation, but I wrote it, and the people in Integrity Music, right, had heard some of my music, etc., and they wanted to publish some of the music, etc., particularly that song, and they liked it, and I said, oh, thank you very much, etc., etc., and so they made an album, and they said, we're going to call this album All for Jesus. See, and I already had an album called All for Jesus that the guys in Kingsway down around the corner there in the south of London, they'd already done that. And I said to the American guy that was doing it, I said, look, if you put out an album called All for Jesus, and there's another one, now there's another one already called All for Jesus, that's going to be stupid because people will walk into a store and say, could I have Robin Mark's song All for Jesus? And then they'll say, well, which one? You know?
Yeah.
So he went away, and then he came back again. He said, okay, we're not going to call it that. We're going to call it Revival in Belfast. Now, this was in the middle of the Troubles. And I actually, when he said it, I thought, I don't think we really had a revival just yet in Belfast, you see. So I was beginning to think to myself, oh, these guys are going to hate me. And what this guy said, lovely, lovely guy that he was, actually, he said, you know what, Robin? It's a word of faith. And so that song, the sort of revival, came out of that word of faith of that American guy, you know, because...
Wow, so you had the album title before you had the song.
Yeah.
Wow. So that's unusual.
No, it is. It is. So I'm not so sure how I actually then fitted the song into the actual thing. But it started really just as me saying, right, okay, you know, if this guy believes that God's going to revive Northern Ireland, he's going to make a change here, then... I living there should be doing it and should be looking for it. And so I wrote the song, you know, as sure as gold is precious and the honey sweet, you love this city and you love these streets, because it was about Belfast. It was about our town, and the rest of the lyrics, et cetera, et cetera. The one interesting thing about that song, and it again is why I like to do something only if I'm inspired, was there were some people, the Troubles were nearly over at that time. Okay, we were in a better place, so things were doing quite well, and so there was a lot of rebuilding in Belfast because there were buildings that had been damaged and destroyed and stuff like that. And so and there were some of the guys that were building some of the structures and refixing, etc. And one of them actually came to me. I think he was a Christian, you know, but he might not have been. He was a big, tough sort of building type guy. And he said, you know, you know your song, you have a song, and you say in it, we love this city, or you love this city and you love these streets, about God, you see? And I said, yeah, that's the song Revival. And he says, would you mind if we put a big poster up that in May Street in Belfast that says, you love this city and you love these streets, right? And I mean, like, what could you say? I said, yeah, absolutely. I would not mind at all. And so they put this thing above May Street so that when you come around in the bus or around your car across the building that they had it on, it just said, you love this city and you love these streets. And, you know, again, that was just something that came out of a conversation and just out of keeping my eyes open.
Are you still waiting, though, for the kind of fulfillment of some of those words that you wrote, do you think?
I think we are. I think we are. I do know that Northern Ireland and Belfast is a much better place than it is. And the people still have a very good, I mean, the majority of people have a very good sense of faith and understanding of Christ's purposes for cities and people and et cetera. And the church is still growing in Northern Ireland. And you do believe, and I do hope for, you know, more and more sort of grace and I'm not sure, because of the way it was written, of course, everybody mostly sort of says, right, okay, revival, one of those things like happened 100 years ago when the Azusa revival, you know, when like thousands of people became. And I know that there's a number of theologians and a number of pastors out there all over the world who really believe that that's going to go. I'm not sure. I hope. I really, really hope. But I think the revival that probably prompted that song was just that, you know, if you like, the rebuilding of a city that had gone through something really. But yes, I think like all of us that are Christians and who know the sort of, when you look at the way the world's going and you look back at history, et cetera, you know, and I have friends in America and different people there who are saying, you know, they really, really believe that God's going to send a huge worldwide revival. I really hope so, you know. I hope so.
That's really interesting what you say there about the city being revived. Because I guess, maybe for those who haven't been to Belfast, it's hard to understand. But I guess to use a personal example, I was born at a time, I was born in 1989, My understanding in 1989, I don't think Belfast was a tourist destination, let's put it that way. Well, I went to Belfast on holiday a few years ago, and it was amazing. It was absolutely incredible. And you just think, well, on a very kind of non-spiritual, you know, on a very physical kind of level, there has been in your city, in Belfast, in the last 30 years, very dramatic change in terms of just the physical place. And as you say, that the troubles, thankfully, largely now being a thing of the past, I suppose.
Yeah. Yeah, no, you're absolutely right, and I think, I mean, that for sure, we had some very good, nice politicians and some very good people and lots of social workers, et cetera, and all sorts of things, but I do believe that it was God's grace that brought us from that place to this place, and that to me, it the word revival just fits.
Yeah. You said earlier on you believe that, I think you said God's favour is on Northern Ireland. I'd love to hear a bit more about that, because I suppose, you know, obviously I interview a lot of people for this show, and particularly those who live in London or England, or probably wouldn't say that about England at the moment. I mean, maybe some would, but that's not something I commonly hear. So it's interesting to hear you say that about Northern Ireland, feel like God's favour is on you. So I'd love to hear a bit more about that.
Ooh. You put me in a corner right now. See, I'm not sure exactly if, well, I stand to be corrected, but I do feel that there is something unique about this country, for starters. Well, there's something unique about every country, and but in terms of its roots, it has sort of been a Christian country. Plus, plus, plus. You know, I think even in the bad old days when one of the political parties, and I'll not name which one, made the council take all the swings down and lock them up on a Sunday, so that children wouldn't swing on because the Sunday was a day of rest, etc. That's we actually had that at one time, and I remember thinking that's a little bit strange. So it has been a very religious place, but it has gone through, I suppose, because it has gone through such trouble and such tribulation, and yet people outside that you'll meet who maybe have suffered very, very badly in the history of Northern Ireland have a grace with them and a sense of forgiveness and a sense of actually changing their mind and opinions about other people and other people's beliefs and other people's desires, etc. And I know we're not completely there, but I do feel that there is something about the fact that we were in a place of terror, absolute terror, and now we've been brought into a place of grace because things are good. I'm sure a lot of your readers or a lot of your listeners, etc., wouldn't know, but you know, there were lots of times and lots of years in our recent history when you couldn't go out at night. I couldn't have gone to a certain part of the town. I remember when I was doing a proper job, I was actually an acoustic consultant many years ago when I was looking after a little club, a Gaelic club, and where they were making too much noise for the neighbours, and so I had to go down and try and help them reduce the noise. And they were next door to a homing pigeon club, would you believe, that was basically Protestant. And the Gaelic club was a Catholic club. And I was going down to help both of them. And on one night, they rang me up and said, Robin, don't come down because there's trouble here and they're just looking for people to shoot or whatever. So just don't come down today. And, when someone says about your town, you know, don't come down the street in case you get shot, that gives you an idea of how bad it would be. And so when we look now, basically you can walk from one end of a Belfast to the other, and for the most part, no one will give you any trouble at all. There's a lot of greenery stuff. The council's working very well together. The politicians are working well together. Some of them don't like each other, but you know. And so there is a little sense of grace, I think, that has been born out of being in a place that was troubling, just to use a word. And I suppose that's what it is. For us, even the small things, I think, even the small things are a joy.
Coming back a little bit to your story, can you pinpoint a time looking back where you've realised, wow, these songs are going places, and your music and you were starting to be known way beyond Belfast, but actually all over the world? Is there a point looking back you think that was the point I sort of woke up and realised, wow, God, for whatever reason, God is really allowing my music to travel and I'm having an influence far wider than presumably you ever thought you would?
Absolutely. It probably was the Americans. Those Americans. Hello, Americans.
Many of them listen to this podcast. We love our American friends. No, despite all their quirks, we do love them.
Well, basically, I got a phone call, from America, and it was from the Integrity guys, etc. I have no idea how they got wind of my song or whatever, but this guy on the other side said, "Look, we have heard your song. You've written a song called Elijah." And I think I remember correcting him and saying, "No, Days of Elijah." I said, "Look, we'd like to come and record it in Northern Ireland, and we'd like to bring our engineers, etc., etc." And I thought, really? And I said, wait, okay, all right, if you want. And so they came to Belfast and they came to our church and they brought all the equipment. There was gear that we had never even seen before in our lives, would you believe? And they came in and they said, okay, well, we're going to put this album out and we're going to put it all over the world. And I thought, really? You know, this cannot be. And at the end of the actual thing, you know, if you're Irish, sometimes you're interested in financial things, you see. We do like to be a little bit careful with our money, etc. And I said to the guy, you know, how much is this costing you to do? Because they'd flown people over in planes, airplanes, etc., gear, etc. And this is way back, way back. And he says, it was $127,000. And I thought, what? So somebody, now, there's a pre-story to that, which I think is really quite interesting. That at that point, I thought, somebody spent $127,000 to get me to sing a couple of songs. You know, they're out of their mind. But what actually happened was, I've got a good friend called Ronnie, and he had a shoe shop in Belfast, and he was a great guy, Christian guy, went to our church, and it's a body that looks after missionaries overseas. I can't even remember the name of the actual thing. I think it's Haggai Ministry or something like that. It's not the name, and the ministry is sort of different, but he was sort of sponsoring that here, and he was the sort of representative in Northern Ireland, etc. And he was a businessman, etc. And he was, you know, used to going overseas, etc., on holiday, etc. So for some reason, he ended up in Atlanta, Georgia, on a holiday. And he was there to go to the, oh, that's right, it was a conference of this Haggai Ministries, because, you know, they would have them all over the world. And he went, and he was in the Haggai Ministry sort of location. It was a big sort of a building, you know, with all sorts of options, you know, rooms, etc., and down there in Atlanta. And he got bored by the stuff that he was hearing. And so he went for a walk, and he walked outside, and there was another building, another sort of a large building, and there was a thing, conference going on there, and it was a music conference. And so he walked over to this music conference. It was for the music industry, the Christian music industry in America. He had no idea. He had a little lanyard and a ticket that was letting him into the Haggai Ministries thing. And he walked across the street, and he walked into the thing, and the guy, the security man, the door, just looked at the, you know, the tag and let him come through. And he walked through, and Integrity Music were there. And they had a stand, and they had some music and stuff like that. And he was walking around and looking at all this stuff. And a guy behind the desk said, "How you doing? Where are you from?" And Ronnie said, "I'm from Northern Ireland." And he said, "What brings you here?" And he said, "Well, I was over at the Haggai conference, but I got bored, so I just came in to see what was here." And the fella said to him, "How'd you get in?" And he said, "Well, I don't know. I just showed my little lanyard and walked in." And this guy, who became a good friend of mine, actually said to him, "Is there any music in Northern Ireland? There must be music in Ireland. Is there any Christian music in Northern Ireland?" And Ronnie, the shoe salesman, said to him, "Yeah, I know a guy in our church. He sings songs. And I'll send you a couple of his songs." And that was actually how the whole thing started to go, you know, which was unbelievable, because it was just, a God incident, as some people say, you know. And I suppose when stuff like that happens, and I think back, I say, well, there you go. God had a hand in it, because A, Ronnie shouldn't have been there. B, he snuck into a thing. And C, the guy that he was talking to was actually one of the people that actually pick songs and put them out, etc., for Integrity. The last thing was when they said to me, I think Revival in Belfast sold on its own something like, I think by now, something like 2.5 million copies, you know. It's a huge number of things. And I thought, oh, I'm famous. But not really. that was it, you know.
That was it. Yeah, amazing. Well, I know we've talked a lot about your past music, but I'd love to hear about what you're doing right now. So bring us up to date a little bit. Are you, I think you mentioned you're sort of semi-retired, but are you working on new music? And tell us a bit about what you're up to at the moment.
I am afraid to say that I'm doing a Christmas album.
Hey!
And there you go. And I must admit, like many people in this business, I'd said, oh no, not another Christmas. And then when someone else did one, go, oh gosh, you know, he's doing a Christmas album.
Yes.
But here I am, and I finally decided, you know what? I'd like to do a Christmas album. So I'm actually working on that now. I've got my musicians primed. We're hoping to put it out in, I think, for this Christmas.
Brilliant. Know? Great. Are these going to be new songs that you've written, or are you covering old hymns?
There will be a few of the new songs, and we will be putting some of the oldies and stuff like that. And it should be a little bit different. Because of this flaw, if you like, or gift that I have where I get inspired, I'll give you, for example, there's a song that's going to go on it called I Don't Know Johnny, right? No, that doesn't sound like a Christian song, but it sort of is. But what actually happened was about 2 years ago, 3 years ago, when the British home stores still existed. I don't know if you remember the British home stores.
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, they're all gone now, I think.
Yeah.
All that stuff about Mr. Green and the money that went somewhere. So I was doing a bit of last-minute Christmas shopping, like all men, you know, right in the last part. And I was in Belfast. And I saw the shop, you know, British Home Stores, and I thought, oh, they sometimes have nice little things that are in, you know, that I might like to buy for my wife or whatever. So I walked over. It was near closing time, actually, and there was an elderly couple, as I'm allowed to say, I think, an elderly couple just in front of me, a guy, a woman and her husband. And, you know, within about two paces into the shop, I realized I was in the wrong place, you see, so because it was nothing really worth buying. But they were right in front of me, and the husband had picked something up off a shelf, and he said to his wife, what about this for Bob? And she said, oh, I don't know, Johnny, like that. And she sounded so tired and fed up with it, with Christmas shopping. And immediately I started to write a song. I don't know, Johnny, that's what she said, with a shrug of her shoulder and a shake of her head. You know, just about that. That's the way songs come to me.
Yeah.
And that's not a Christian song. It is really, it goes, you know, for that, but.
We'll keep an eye out for that. But yeah. Sadly, our hour is up and we're out of time, but Robin Mark, thank you so much for talking. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Oh, my pleasure. Absolutely. Absolutely. Sam.
Hi, I'm Marcus Jones, Chief Digital Officer at Premier, which produces this podcast and many others. Like you, I love listening to these amazing podcasts. I also love hearing about the people who are impacted by them, like Sheila from Cheshire. Sheila's parents were both sick and she was going through a difficult time taking care of them. But she started listening to Premier's podcasts and God spoke to her through them with just the right thing she needed to hear at just the right moment. She felt reassured that God had it in hand and that her parents would be safe. It's incredible to know how important these podcasts are to so many, but they are listener funded, which means we need your support to keep them going for people like Sheila. This week, we come to the end of our financial year with our funding need yet to be met. Would you consider a donation today to help us reach more people like Sheila with hope and encouragement through our podcasts? Give your gift today at premier.plus/donate. That's premier.plus/donate. Thank you.